What time does this meeting end?
10:30.
10:30? That's what he said. 9? Okay, and when do the recovery people have to be back in the halfway house? 9? Okay, just wanted to be sure, because I have been known to be long-winded, so I didn't. No, I have, but anyway. Well, my name is Rochelle, and I am a real alcoholic. Hi, everybody. I guess you're wondering, or even if you're not wondering, why I said I'm a real alcoholic. I'll tell you, because it means a lot to me. It took me 3 years in the program to become a real alcoholic. And it's described in the big book around, I don't know, the 20s pages, early 20s. When I came in the program in 1982, my sobriety date is April 11th, 1982. It was Easter Sunday. That's one of the things Vincent and I have in common. We came in on Easter. We're both Easter eggs or something. What was I going to say? What was I talking about? Oh, real alcoholic. Thank you. I'm glad you're listening. This is going to happen a lot. It's a mind fart. I didn't used to have them as much when I drank. I remembered everything when I drank. I was positive of that. It's only been since I quit drinking. A lot of things bad have happened to me since I quit drinking. I don't know. But anyway, it happened again. Oh, real alcoholic. Came into the program April 11th. And what happened? Oh, I believed I was an alcoholic for sure. And I don't know, after about 6 months or so, I think, roughly 6 to 9 months, I felt a lot better. After all, I wasn't as bad as most alcoholics. I didn't have to go to treatment. And, you know, I had all my teeth. And I didn't have a DUI. I had a good job. I was a lot thinner then. And, you know, I had enough dates and everything. I mean, actually, there wasn't that much wrong with my life. And I had decided I needed to come to AA. So by 6 to 9 months, I wasn't even that unhappy about anything. So I thought I had overreacted to this thing, you know. So I just kind of hung out for a while, and I had decided, didn't tell anybody, that I wasn't going to hang out too much longer. Because, you see, I didn't need AA for anything by then, because I'd figured out how not to drink, and isn't that all this was about? And figured out how not to drink, and I didn't need any people in AA, because I didn't come here for friends. You know, people used to tell me, why don't you call some women in AA, and why don't you make friends? And I said, I don't need friends. I didn't come here for friends. Thank you very much. I have plenty of friends. And, I mean, I have people to go to dinner with and go to movies with. So, you know, I came here to learn how to stay clean and sober, and that's it. So, thank you. And then they would try to tell me things like about my life. You know, they were real nosy in AA. And I mean, really nosy. But I have to tell you, if you're new in AA and you wonder about the nosiness, actually, they're not nosy in AA. There is no nosiness or any gossip in AA. It's actually loving concern. I mean, I found that out. But in those days, I thought they were nosy. They used to want to know, like, they used to want to tell me not to date and all that kind of stuff. Because I was single. And I just resented all that. I mean, it was none of their business as far as I was concerned. So, and who my friends were was none of their business, and I let them know that right off the bat. And If I didn't agree with something, I let them know that right off the bat. Not that anybody ever asked me anything, but I was willing to just let them know my opinion if it differed. And when I first came to my first meeting in Ohio is where I got sober, Columbus, Ohio, which is around the Mesopotamia of the whole business anyway. Columbus, Cleveland, Akron. It's like a triangle. And we all believe that's where the whole thing started. Cleveland kind of argues with Akron. And then, of course, there's New York. And I used to run over there, too. And New York thinks they did it. So there's sort of this little controversy. But everybody pretty much has agreed that it was Akron, you know. Even Cleveland does now. So all of us in that Cleveland, Akron, Columbus triangle go to meetings a lot within those three cities. And it's one of the most historic places you can get sober. And I would encourage any of you, if you want to travel to any conferences or roundups or anything, that's a good place to go because you learn so much about your ancestors. It's historic. Anyway, so that's where I got sober. And, you know, every place does things differently. So one of the things they do, I was noticing how quiet it is in this meeting, they applaud for everything. Applaud for everything. So in that first meeting, now I feel right at home. Yeah, like if you say your name, my name is Rochelle, and after Wanda read, they would have applauded. After Bob, after everybody did anything, if you burp, fart, or anything, they applaud. And so when I walked in that first meeting, and they'd say, are there any newcomers? And I stood up and said my name. They gave this rousing, like, hooray. And I knew I was home. Because I knew they could see, you know, the value of my worth. And I was immediately also cognizant of the fact that they spotted someone who was going to be able to help these poor unfortunates before too long. Because they could tell I wasn't as bad as everybody else. You know, I had cleaned up, I had taken a shower and everything, and I dressed well before I went to the meeting. And I didn't look bad. I didn't look like an alcoholic. So I took notes that night. It was a speaker meeting. And I took notes because I knew within a week they were going to ask me to do that. All right. Now, that's just to give you a little bit of my personality. Then. And it's nothing like that now. And if you believe that, I have some beads and stuff to sell you. Or, yeah, okay, all right, thank you, Debbie. But what I was like when I was, you know, before all this, I mean, when I even tell you what I was like before, coming to AA, I often think about that like, so what? Because very little of what I'm going to tell you has anything to do with being an alcoholic. The parts that might would be the parts about how I reacted to alcohol when it was in my body, if I threw up a whole bunch of times or blacked out or whatever. The rest of it is my personality, which, you know, is me. And it's not a symptom at all of being an alcoholic. It's me. And so don't try to figure that if you are similar to me in personality, that has anything to do with being an alcoholic. You just might be like me, you know. And I can tell you, I have always been a little bit left of center, a little bit strange, a little bit weird, and a little bit always feeling not quite fitting in with folks. Now, a lot of people say that, and they're uptight about it and upset about it. Most of the time, somebody forgot to turn their phone off. Yeah, I don't know how to do mine either. But anyway, most of the time, I didn't feel all that bad about it because I was different, and that was cool with me because I knew why I was different. There were reasons for that. I discovered why later on in my adulthood when I was good and into my cups. What it was, and I got this corroborated by a fellow alcoholic woman, that I was extraterrestrial. I was from the planet Zorba, and so was she. She corroborated this. This was in Minnesota, and I was at a party at her house, and we were sent here to save the children. Now, she was a psychologist, so I knew she was smart. She had a PhD, and she was wanting me to move to Minnesota to come into her practice, and we were going to do child psychology together and save the children. But we were both from Zorba. We knew that. So that explained, when I was like in my 20s, I found this out, why all this stuff had happened to me in my early years and why I was so different. So see, it didn't bother me that much when I was like 4 and 5 that I was different, because I knew there was this really good reason. So don't put that on your list of a symptom of being an alcoholic or anything, because it wasn't. And I didn't mind being that different, but one of the differences looked like when I was 5 and I went to Catholic school in Alabama. I'm an Army brat, so I lived everywhere. And in those days, I didn't feel that great about much, particularly my family. I thought I was born into the wrong family, that I was switched at birth, one of those things, and did not like my parents, and for lots of different reasons. And so I was kind of upset about them and about my family. And I always wanted to be somewhere else. So I fantasized very early. One of the things that I did was read voraciously. I read all the time Greek and Roman mythology, gods and goddesses, and kind of saw myself as becoming one of those powerful gods or goddesses, mostly the ones of the underworld. Why, I don't know. And then I kind of graduated from them to witchcraft, and not the good little white witches either. The witches that had the really powerful powers, and the warlocks and whatnot. And I really was fascinated by witches and warlocks that had the, you know, the really, you know, could just crash the world kind of powers. And I read a lot of that stuff. And I wondered a lot about stuff, and I asked a lot of questions that nobody particularly wanted to answer. Like, there was one particular question that intrigued me, and from Catholic school, you know, we had to learn the Bible a lot, we read a lot of Bible verses, and I got stuck on Genesis, the first line. In the beginning, there was nothing. Now, what the hell is nothing? It took me, I still haven't figured it out, but when I was 5 in kindergarten, to try to conceptualize nothing was giving me a headache. You know, I would say, okay, nothing. I would close my eyes and there would be this blackness. Well, black is something. And if I squeezed them really tight, I'd see this yellow and stuff in the black. And then, that was something. So then I'd say, okay, but then I think about outer space. Well, then that's space. Space is something, even though I can't see it. Air is something, even though I can't see it. So then maybe I would, you know, and I'd be doing this late at night with a flashlight under the blanket. I would get a jar, like an empty mayonnaise jar. Okay, and then it was empty. And I'd look in it. Well, there was space again. That's supposed to be nothing. It was something. So then I couldn't figure out nothing in the beginning. What in, you know, how do you figure nothing? And how did anybody know, since nobody was there, to see the nothing? I mean, you know, that didn't make sense. How did they know if there was nothing if nobody was there? Okay, so that made me suspicious. But so, of course, since my parents were so smart, you know, I'd, like, ask my mother. So, you know, she'd say, what are you doing in there anyway? You're supposed to be asleep, blah, 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 blah. So I'd say, well, I'm trying to figure out nothing. And she'd say, what do you mean you're trying to figure out nothing? That's what I mean. What are you doing? Nothing. And I said, no, I want to figure out what is nothing. She said, well, what do you mean nothing? I said, well, I want to know what nothing is. What do you mean nothing? You know, and I said, well, nothing. I can't think of what. That's right. You're not doing anything. You're supposed to be asleep. And I said, no, it's nothing. It's nothing. Well, it is something that you're doing. You got the flashlight under the thing. And she never understood what I was trying to say about nothing. Nobody would ever engage me in a serious conversation about nothing. They would just say, that's right. You're not doing anything about anything. And it wasn't anything, it was nothing that I was trying to figure out, not anything. So I mean, it was that kind of thing, and people didn't want to talk to me, other kids couldn't understand me, I didn't like other kids, they just got dirty, and I didn't get dirty, I did not like getting dirty. All they did was fight and act stupid. I wanted to have conversations, they could hardly talk. And so I spent a lot of time, you know, bossing kids around, starting little clubs and things where I was the president, and or I didn't play with them if I couldn't. And I was the boss. I was the boss. So, you know, I didn't have low self-esteem like a lot of people did. So, so I think I drank. Let's see, why did I drink? I don't know. I'm not sure why I drank. Well, you know, it was in the family. It was cool. I remember thinking, because I felt so oppressed in my family, I was so oppressed, repressed, suppressed, I had decided that to be free as a woman in the world, I was going to drink alcohol, drink black coffee, and smoke cigarettes. And then I would have arrived. And I did all those three things. I started with the alcohol. My parents allowed me to do that. They allowed all of us kids to do that at home. They wanted us to learn how to do it so we wouldn't make a fool out of ourselves when we went out in the world. The cigarettes came much later. I think I was in college. I did not drink, however, like teenagers. I did not drink in high school. I did not smoke in high school. I was one of those goody-two-shoes kids. Got straight A's. Towed that line. I was really one of those people that didn't want to rock the boat since they were paying for everything. I wanted to get out of everything I had to get out of while they were still paying, and then I was going to do what I wanted to do. So my stuff started a little bit in college, but I wasn't stupid. I was in college during the 60s when everything started getting stirred up, but I wasn't even going to march and everything and get in trouble yet, because they were still paying for everything and I didn't have a job yet, so I wasn't gonna like get arrested or anything. My father was a colonel in the army. I couldn't afford to get arrested, because if you got in trouble and your father was a military guy, he got in trouble. So your getting in trouble then was even more trouble than the average bear, so I couldn't do that. So I just kind of laid low, had a lot of sneaky things in my life that I did. I never had sex, according to Clinton, until I... until I was much older than I thought I was. And thanks to him, I never would have had sex. Ever. I never would have had to have sex. But anyway. And I always loved it. And that was one of the main things I snuck around to do. And alcohol made much easier to do. I was the kind of drinker that the Big Book describes as, I think, periodic, I think. Which meant I just kind of drank every now and then, except when I drank every day, which wasn't often, but it was sometimes. And I didn't drink a lot, except when I did sometimes. That would only be like on the weekends at a party. And I had this system, which I understood very well. If I poured a drink in a glass and I never emptied the glass, it was one drink. I see some of you did that counting. Okay, now if I made a mistake and drank everything in the glass, that was one, and then the next glass was two. But I usually never empty that second one. You know, you just keep pouring on top of that inch that you leave in, or even that eighth of an inch. Whatever you leave in, you never hit the bottom of the glass. And then it was wine that I really liked. As they say in AA, I was a winette. It was so sad when I quit because I had just discovered wine that I actually liked the taste of. And that's when I quit. But anyway, I had my bottle always that nobody drank out of because nobody knew where it was. I never let anybody see it. And I always lived alone pretty much. I mean, I went through a marriage, but, you know, when that ended, I basically was this single, like Sex in the City kind of girl. I liked that. And I kept this one bottle, and I had all kinds of stuff for my guests. And they always were, you know, treated well. I gave good parties. And when the parties were over, I never threw away the alcohol. But don't tell anybody. See, alcohol doesn't kill germs. So it went right back into the bottles that it came out of. And I thought nobody needed to know that. But since it doesn't kill germs, I mean, it does kill germs, it could go back in. And any bacteria was being killed as I was pouring it back into the bottle. And especially the wine, you know, it really killed germs. So all of my alcohol went right back into the bottles from their glasses that they didn't finish. So I was conserving on alcohol. And I thought that made sense. Most of my friends drank pretty much. I don't know if they were alcoholics. I think some of them really were, because they seemed to have problems. None of us thought we had any problems. None of us said we had any problems, and nobody tried to get anybody to quit drinking. In fact, I don't think anybody ever told me to quit drinking. In fact, I never, to this day, I don't understand why an adult would stand for anybody telling them to stop drinking if they're over 21. I don't know. I never could understand that. Why would anybody hide their booze? Why wouldn't they say, I'm over 21. How can you even think about telling me not to drink? Who do you think you are? I mean, that would be my position. Now, on the other hand, I could tell you about your drinking, but don't you even think about telling me. But I had no problem. And usually my job was to tell the men in my life about their drinking, because most of them just were slobs. And I don't know why they seemed to find me. I used to tell my friends it was this asshole magnet in my underwear that they just, you know, because I was the kind of drinker that went out a lot to bars and parties and things. And that's who was attracted to me. So it was like my mission was to save these drunks. And I used to, I used to have to save my mother. So I would collect all the little literature, you know, like from the State Department. I'd never heard of AA, by the way. I'd collect literature from health places, and I'd save it, and then I'd pass it out to these guys that I was dating, tell them what they needed to do, you know. I didn't know anything about treatment. I just knew they needed to quit or cut down. And I also knew how to drink properly, what kind of glass to drink out of. And most of them were really slobs. I mean, they would drink like out of jars and crap like that. I mean, I could throw up watching them drink. And then often, they would spend the night with me and wake up and drink all my stuff out of my bar. Not tell me. I would discover it just quite by accident. You know, when I maybe wanted some liquor, which I hardly ever drank. That's how I knew I wasn't an alcoholic either, because I only drank wine. You know, and that wasn't all that bad. So I would discover all my liquor was gone. I would be fit to be tied. And you know, it's very gauche to drink somebody's entire bar and not bring back. And it's also not cool to bring something when you come visit. You should always bring somebody a bottle of something. Most of these guys never brought anything. Also, most of them drank beer, which I hated. They knew I hated beer. and they would never bring beer. So that was the kind of life I was leading, mostly parties, mostly angry at men, and mostly getting depressed about that and not knowing why, because on paper, if you had seen my life, it looked like I should be happy. And I couldn't figure out why I wasn't happy. I didn't believe in therapy in those days because I was supposed to figure out everything. And couldn't figure out everything. And as smart as I was, it didn't make any sense. There was a lot going on that, as I look back, made sense why I was depressed. Didn't know it then, I know it now, and of course it makes sense. The way I hit my bottom makes no sense to me, because it was not remarkable at all. It was so ordinary to me, except for the part that it was Easter Sunday. There was nothing about it that was more than an ordinary Sunday. And I have a feeling there's just a lot of spiritual stuff that it had to, for me, had to be that way, because I was pretty much, I don't know if I was agnostic by then. I mean, I started out in Catholic school and then went from that to, over the years, just putting away religion on the shelf, because when I was 16, my dad mandated that I be baptized the old-fashioned way in the water and everything. And somehow, when they did that dunking, I like inhaled when I was under the water. Freaked me out. Thought I was drowning, and you know, they're singing way in the water. It was like a funeral dirge, and then I came back up, sputtering and everything, and like nobody was paying attention to that I was drowning. You know, I mean, I was traumatized by this whole thing. And you know, those sheets were clinging. I mean, it was so embarrassing. I was 16 and standing up in front of all these people who thought I was crying out of that happy cry, you know. I mean, I was so humiliated. I'll never forget that day. I made a promise to myself that day. I said, as soon as I get big enough and free enough, I will never set foot in one of these buildings again. If it's the last thing I ever do, I will never, ever, ever do that again. And I pretty much kept that promise once I could get away and be able to make that choice, because I just got scared to death. I never wanted to decide that early what I was going to do spiritually, and I was just furious that my father forced it. And it was one of the few times that my mother didn't agree with him as well. She thought we should be able to make our minds up. And so I just had this awful thing stuck in my head off of this. And so religion just kind of became a on-the-shelf thing for me, and I just negated it as if it had nothing to do with my life. So that's why getting, you know, having Easter Sunday be my last anything is just, that's the remarkable thing. But nothing else in my life was. I used to quit drinking every now and then, but you have to understand, that wasn't because I'm an alcoholic or anything. It was for dieting purposes, because alcohol has calories in it. And so, you know, there weren't too many diets that would let you drink, except for the Atkins diet. And so I did that one a lot. So I think I had just finished like 3 months of the Atkins diet, and I might have started back drinking, probably. Yeah, I was, because everything was fine now. And it was a sunny day, I remember, which was already unusual in Columbus, Ohio, because there was hardly any sun, and we were celebrating. I had decided to quit the job that I was doing. I was always in these male category jobs, you know, in corporate. The first half of my life was corporate America, and I was always in these management jobs where there had been no women before, And there I was, hating every moment of it and feeling stuck. So this was an automotive company where I had to drive 40 miles one way every day, and I hated it. So I had decided to go into business with this woman I knew and do something else and make millions of dollars. So, I mean, I was just like in fantasy land. And we went to lunch to talk about this business on this sunny Sunday. It was wonderful. And Local wine had just come out. So we ordered a bottle. I had poured a glass, and I was thrilled because I could drink and lose weight at the same time. So I was really happy about that. Now, I had a couple of sips, and I remember it was like two sips. And then that thing happened that had always started to happen, oh, the last few years of my drinking. It never ceased to happen. And that was kind of a Jekyll and Hyde experience. It was like inside of me, this other person was forming. And the other me, I don't mean like another personality or anything, but the me that's talking to you now started getting agitated and started getting on the mean side. I was a mean drunk. And I would get so nasty in a very short period of time that, you know, it just wasn't worth being with me. And I would tell you what was wrong with you and keep telling you what was wrong with you. And I was right. And sometimes I would tell you at the top of my lungs. And I could do it all night. I didn't have to sleep when I'd get on these tirades. Usually guys got the benefit of this. Usually the guys I dated or married got the benefit of this. But anyway, but I felt horrible when this would happen too. My gut would be wrenching. It was the worst feeling. It was the worst emotional feeling. And I didn't want to have it that day. And it was beginning to happen already. And I could never control it. It was already out of control. The only way to do anything was just to stop drinking like that moment. But then sometimes it was already starting. So I kind of put the glass down and I had this weird look and my girlfriend said, "What's the matter?" I said, "Nothing. You know, it's just the drink. I can't think when I drink." And she said, "Oh, so the drink is bothering you." And I said, "No, actually drinking doesn't bother me. It's just that I can't think when I drink." And she said, "Oh, then it's the drink." And I said, "No, you don't understand. It's just that when I drink, I can't think." And she said, "Oh." So then she kept looking at me curiously, and I said, "Well, see, the thing is, when I go home, I'm moving, so I have to pack. And when I drink, you know, my physicalness is kind of, I can't, like, do too much physically because I start slowing down and I want to go to sleep." And she said, "Oh, then there's something about the wine that's bothering." "No, it's just that when I drink, I can't do much physically. I get tired easily, and then I have to go to sleep." "Okay, so it's not the wine." No, I can drink. It's just, you know, when I drink, I can't lift boxes and do a lot of work." I thought I was making sense. She didn't understand me. But anyway, I had to leave soon because when I drink, I can't predict what I'm going to do next. So I left, and I went home. And the rest of that day is pretty much a blur, except for the fact that this boyfriend that needed to stop drinking dropped by to help me pack. And I found myself in the basement looking through the box of pamphlets to find one to tell me how to talk to this drunk about how bad he is without him hitting me. I mean, I knew there was one that would say, "How to talk to a drunk about how bad he is without him hitting you in the mouth." So anyway, I opened this pamphlet and it said, "My name is John and I'm an alcoholic." And I thought, "Oh, this would be good." And I started reading this thing. Within seconds, I was in tears. I was sobbing. This was me. I couldn't begin to tell you what this little story was about, but it was the equivalent of somebody standing up here telling their story, and it was me. Shocked the doo-doo out of me. And I just started shaking. I read the entire story. I was not expecting it, and I was just mesmerized. And I read every little piece of everything I had. I completely forgot about the guy. I don't remember much about the rest of the evening. I knew I had to go to my parents' house the next day, which was Easter. And I knew I could not drink again, and I knew that there is a God, and I knew it was going to help me. I didn't know about AA yet. And I knew I was an alcoholic. And so those are the remarkable things that happened on this totally unremarkable day when my life was totally ordinary. And so the next day, you know, I took a Valium. It was only one little 5 milligram. And that's, you know, that's my sobriety date. Because even then, I knew that there's something else I could have done. Even though I didn't know what it was, I knew there should have been something else that I should have been able to do. And I still believe that. And now I know there's something else I could have done. But I don't know what it was, and it doesn't matter that I didn't know then. I mean, I just think there's something else. So that's my last anything. And I haven't had a drink since then, or a pill, or anything. And I'm not bragging about it. I'm glad of it. And I think a lot of it has to do with getting sober in Ohio, where they humiliate you into sobriety. They kick your ass, at least for the first 2 or 3 years. And, you know, that whole time for the 3 years when I was in doubt, they said, you know, it's okay if you don't know if you're an alcoholic. Just don't drink while you're trying to figure it out. So, you know, I thought that was the best move. And when I found out I was a real alcoholic was the third year, and this great guy, who I don't know if he's still alive or not, from Mississippi, his name is Franklin W., and his home group is a big book study, which, by the way, I'm a real big book, whatever you want to call it. I really promote that and really encourage people to do that, because you'll learn a lot about your ancestors and you'll learn about the history. And I really promote reading all the other books that support that book, because you need more than that just to understand what that one's even about. But until I started reading the history, I didn't really understand much about the big book. But anyway, this guy's home group is the big book. And he started out talking, saying he was a real alcoholic. And if you want to know what one is, read page 21 and 22. And I always liked the challenge, because I wasn't a real one yet. And I thought, OK, let me go home and see that. And then he went on to say that you really need to know if you are or not, because you won't stay if you're not. There's no reason to. And I knew that. And I was at that point where it's been 3 years already. You know, I don't feel much happier or anything, and I'm still making the same mistakes. I'm with this other guy in the program who I'm not happy about. And, you know, even though I was right to date him in the first year, and I had a good rationale, which I won't bore you with, but it was good. So I went home and read that night, and I encourage you to read it if you're on the fence at all, but you'll be on the fence a lot. I was on the fence a lot, but I read it, and it hit me, because I was in there. You know, I forget what it said now that hit me, but it had something to do with medicine. Because see, I didn't do street drugs. I'm a classist. I am a arrogant, narcissistic classist. And I wasn't as bad as, so I didn't do drugs. That was medicine prescribed by my doctor. Thank you very much. So there's something in that book about people who showed up at doctor's office and took a lot of medicine. And I thought, shit, that's me. Just because I didn't buy it from the dealer on the street doesn't mean I'm any less of a drug addict. And my thing was pain pills. And so I had a hard row to hoe coming in and withdrawing. I mean, it was awful that first year. Awful, awful, awful. Because I had to do it at home, and I was on the phone every night. It was awful. But anyway, that's where I saw myself. And I had no more doubts after that. That does not mean that I didn't think I was better. It doesn't mean that I didn't think I could leave anytime I wanted, because I just didn't relate to people. And I thought I should just go. I still had that up and down thing. However, all those awful feelings I had in those first two or three years, and all that anxiety and all that icky, awful trigger warning sign, whatever business, that goes away. That went away. I can't tell you when, but it did. The harder I worked on what they call the defects of character, which I think are just what human beings have, these emotional struggles, and I mean work my ass off on them and continue to do, I think that's the job that I have to do. The big book says, unless I have a complete psychic change, transformation, there's going to be very little hope of recovery, which is not about quitting drinking to me. And Bill Wilson really hits it on the head somewhere in the book, where he says, we're pretty stupid if we think that sobriety is enough. And so that's one of the things that was almost beaten into my head, because for a while I thought that's all we had to do. And I had to get it. And I mean, in Ohio, they only let you get away with being really stupid for about 90 days. And then it was like, go to work. And, you know, if you're serious. And they were pretty, I thought, mean. In fact, I still think kind of mean in the meetings. And I'm not so sure now that it's mean, but they were very serious. And with newcomers, you never heard their voice. I mean, nobody heard my voice for the first year, you know, after they finally got me to shut up, you know, because I would just be pontificating about nothing. I mean, I didn't understand that the meetings were to help alcoholics who were suffering. Well, I was one of them, and I didn't know how to do that. So, but I mean, really, the old-timers were pretty sweet, and they had a lot of patience with me, because they did know I was serious, and they helped me a lot, which I was happy about. And I mean, there was a lot of pain, too. I'm not going to tell you that it was an easy road to hoe. It was a bitch most of the time. I didn't know who I was. I made tons of mistakes. I hardly did anything anybody told me to do, because I knew everything. And you know, when you know everything, you don't ask anybody anything. And so you're pretty much out there on your own. I wouldn't recommend that to anybody. It's the hard way. You don't have to drink, though. I proved that. So I never understand why people say, oh, then I had to drink. No, you don't. It's a choice. I made up my mind I wasn't going to do that, but I did every other damn thing that caused me more pain and heartache than I ever want you all to go through. To me, drinking is the least of it. The least of it. I put myself through more hell than I ever wish for any of you. And I did it for at least the first 5 years. And, you know, it's my story. It's stuff that had started in my life way before I came to AA, and it was playing out. I had made some decisions, and they were playing out. You all made decisions. I made decisions back there. Some of them are still playing out. And I'm having to deal with them. I'm dealing with them differently now because I have a lot of help. And that's a big difference. And the pain isn't as bad. You know, it's there sometimes. I'm not depressed anymore. I was depressed for the first 13 years in this program. And I made the mistake of thinking because I was in the program, everything was supposed to be cool. That was really not too bright. Being in the program doesn't guarantee that my life is supposed to be some kind of fantasy. Life is life. You know, the program is a tool. It's not the only tool I need. I'm also in therapy, and I also go to the dentist for my teeth, and I get my car fixed at a service station. I don't bring it to AA. So, you know, there are lots of things. But anyway, I think I've talked enough. But it definitely saved my life and continues to, and I can't say enough about it. And I think you can do it any way you want to, backwards, forwards, or whatever. It does help, I think, if you don't drink. However, I think there's a lot of other stuff that needs to be done along with that, because it can be hell a lot of different ways. And I think the key is to decide to change your whole life, which is what I'm trying to do on a regular basis. And I hope that's what you're deciding to do. It's a bitch. But I love it. So thank you very much.